Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Shmot. I'm happy to announce that we have a Twitter account now for the podcast. The name is Pardes Podcast, all one word. That's P-A-R-D-E-S Podcast. And I will be announcing each new episode of the podcast on the Twitter account. So start following us and you'll get all the info right away. This week there is a handout for the shiur, so I'll send that as the next podcast episode. Look for that and use it to follow along with Rabbi Daniel Roth as he discusses Shmot. Rabbi Daniel Roth is a faculty member at Pardes and the director of the Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution. And now, Rabbi Daniel Roth.
Thank you, Larry. The following shiur is based upon one of the units that I teach in the framework of the Pardes Center for Judaism and Conflict Resolution, and it deals with one of the larger questions of how do we interpret conflict? How do we interpret the enemy other? And specifically, how do we interpret the motives of why one people would want to oppress another people? And this question rises in the framework of this week's Parsha, Parsha Shmot, with Paro's declaration to his people as to why they need to enslave the Hebrews, the Jewish people. And I read here from Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. And a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are much too numerous for us. Let us deal shrewdly with them so that they may not increase. Otherwise, in the event of war, they may join our enemies in fighting against us and rise from the land." Or in Hebrew, "Va'ala min ha'aretz," and they will go up from the land. And as a result of this concern, Pharaoh convinces his people that they need to oppress and ultimately enslave the Hebrews. But the question that the interpreters have to struggle with is what was his real concern and how legitimate were his fears? How much of a threat were the Hebrews, were the Ivrim really to the Egyptians? What were they going to do to them? That they could increase? That they would join the enemy, and then what? Then they will go up from the land? What does that mean? Why is that a threat? So in general, we could separate the commentaries throughout history into two larger camps. One camp that sees Pharaoh's concerns and fears as extremely unbased in real existential threats, but rather based upon greed, xenophobia, and other unsympathetic concerns, we'll call them. The earliest commentary that kind of goes in this direction is the early Jewish historian Josephus in his book, Antiquities of the Jews, book 2, chapter 9. And this is from the year, more or less, of the first year 100 or for the first century, where Josephus' whole retelling of the story of the enslavement reads as follows. And listen to how he is interpreting now how serious was Paro's concerns of what the Hebrews could do to them. This is how he writes. "Now it happened that the Egyptians grew delicate and lazy as to painstaking and gave themselves up to other pleasures, and in particular to the love of gain. They also became very ill-affected towards the Hebrews, as touched with envy at their prosperity. For when they saw how the nation of the Israelites flourished and were become eminent, already in plenty of wealth, which they had acquired by their virtue and natural love of labor, they thought their increase was to their own detriment. And having in length of time forgotten the benefits they had received from Josephus, particularly the crown being now come into another family, they became very abusive to the Israelites and contrived many ways of afflicting them. For they enjoined them to cut a great number of channels for the river and build walls for their cities and ramparts, ramparts, that they might restrain the river and hinder its waters from stagnating upon its running over to its own banks. They set them also to build pyramids, and by all of this wore them out, exhausted their race, and forced them to learn all sorts of mechanical arts and to accustom themselves to hard labor. And 400 years did they spend under these afflictions. Notice how in Josephus' retelling of the story of the oppression, there's no real existential threat that can be taken seriously from the Egyptian perspective. Rather, they simply wanted to keep the social hierarchies of race very clear within their society, that the Egyptians were on top, and any foreigner like the Hebrews, the Israelites, should be on the bottom. But yet the Israelites posed a seemingly threat that they had possessed too much money. They had acquired too much wealth. And I love this this language of how he describes that they thought that their increase, meaning the increase of wealth of the Israelites, was to their own detriment, but it really wasn't. It could have even been to their benefit. This is a classic anti-Semitic narrative. Non-Jew interpreting Jew having power way beyond their real strength. And this happens often with any kind of minority group that seems to be more powerful than really they might be. So here it's based upon jealousy, upon greed, upon keeping social hierarchies. But a similar interpretations can be found amongst the classic rabbinic medieval interpreters, commentaries, that it was not based upon a real fear that something terrible could happen to the Egyptians, but rather out of greed, out of increase in possessions, monetary reasons. The Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, 11th century France, grandson of Rashi, writes, for example, as follows, "And they will fight us and leave the land, to return to their native land. It is not good for us," he says, "to lose our slaves and be called a truncated kingdom." Now, I honestly don't understand entirely what the Rashbam is referring to, as the Israelites were not yet slaves. But nevertheless, the concern that he's inserting here within the Egyptian story, which is, why do we need to oppress them? Because we don't want to lose our slaves, our manual labor, that they are essential for our economy. Here, the association that strikes me is as if Paro would be likened to Jefferson Davis, for example, the president of the Confederacy, of a people that are willing to go ahead and create more oppression and fight in order to keep their slave labor. But that doesn't give us an extremely sympathetic read to the Egyptians. A similar commentary could be found with the Ramban on Exodus, also chapter 1, verse 10, where he explains that the concern of Paro was, they will get themselves up out of the land, and the land of Canaan, with all of our belongings, and we will not be able to wreak our vengeance on them, nor to war against them. Here again, the concern is not that the Egyptians will be destroyed physically, but rather that they will lose their money from the Israelites perhaps one day leaving. And that's the motivation behind enslaving them. And finally, if we fast forward to 21st century academic interpretations, in the Anchor Bible, the classic academic scholarly interpretation of the Bible, commentary on the Bible, describes this Paro as a young king, as a king that's headstrong and would exemplify the folly of youth upon attaining power. Meaning he's doing anything to kind of create a power base for himself as this young new dictator. And on verse 9, where he is discussing the verse of greater and mightier than us, the author writes as follows. Thus, chapter 1, verse 9, makes the historically preposterous claim that the Israelites became more powerful than the Egyptians. Pharaoh's paranoia is ludicrous, yet sinister. Demagogues often credit weak minorities with vast powers. Elsewhere, the Bible depicts the Egyptian ruling class as obviously xenophobic. Egyptian sources attest to their tight control on immigration and emigration. From here, we see that Paro had no real legitimate fears. He used it in a sinister way to gain power by giving over, by assigning exaggerated power to minority groups. And he did that as part of racism, xenophobia in general, and for personal power gain in particular. But there is a totally different way of reading this story, as I alluded to in the beginning. One that does assign to Paro an honest, serious concern of the threat the Israelites pose for the Egyptians and Egyptian society. The earliest commentary that goes in this direction can be found in the Book of Jubilees, as early as the 2nd century before the Common Era. This was a Jewish book, but pre-rabbinic, but also post-biblical. And here he retells the story in his own words. And he describes the fact that the king of Canaan had been fighting against the king of Egypt. He gives a little bit of historical background. And the king of Egypt had been killed by the king of Canaan. And in the context of describing this ongoing conflict between the king of Canaan and the king of Egypt, it mentions that the children of Israel had made a point of burying their forefather, or the head of the family of Jacob, in Canaan. And actually some of them continued to stay in Canaan, expressing the deep connection that the Israelites had with Canaan specifically, and not with Egypt. Therefore, the Israelites were actually associated as a fifth column connected to the enemy of Egypt. And this enemy of Egypt was not a weaker side, but it was actually more powerful. It had killed the king of Canaan, of Egypt. As it says, and the king of Canaan was victorious over the king of Egypt, and he closed the gates of Egypt, right, that he had initially killed him, and then the Egyptians closed the gates, not letting anyone in and out. And then Paro says, we have to be careful with the Israelites who are living amongst us within our gates, after we've closed all the immigration and emigration. They're living amongst us, even within our own fences. And he says they'll join with them, and if war comes to us, or before they battle with us, or if not, that then they will mix with our enemy and they will depart from our land because their hearts and their faces are upon the land of Canaan. And they oppressed and they appointed over them taskmasters to make them suffer in slavery, and they built strengthened cities for Pharaoh, Phitom, and Ramses, and they built all of the walls and all of the ramparts which had fallen in the cities of Egypt. Meaning, the same walls and ramparts that had been destroyed by the Canaanites, those that are connected ethnically with the Israelites, were the ones that the Israelites were assigned to have to rebuild. So his claims of fears were not ludicrous here at all. This is not unbased xenophobia. This was a real concern that they were living under a constant existential threat of being taken over by the Canaanites, and living amongst them are actually these Israelites who are basically connected to the Canaanites. And that's why he enslaved them. This reminds, in certain associations that come right to my mind, are how the Japanese were treated, for example, in World War II in the United States. This sense of, oh my gosh, we have these people who are associated with our enemy who are living amongst us. 2,000 years later, after the Book of Jubilees was written, Rav Shmuel David Lazzato, a brilliant 19th century Italian rabbi, who was open also to the literary interpretations, the academic interpretations of his non-Jewish associates, writes the following. This is in his commentary on Shmot chapter 1. And a new king arose. The opinion of the scholar guest, who was not Jewish, was that Paro, that was in the time of Exodus, of the Exodus from Egypt, was of the family of Ramses. And the kings from the family of Ramses annihilated 200 years beforehand the quote-unquote shepherd kings that came from the land of Arabia and conquered the Egyptians and ruled over them for 100 years. And behold, he says, that Yosef and afterwards his entire father's house that came down to Egypt during the time of the shepherd kings. And the shepherd kings loved them, since they were all of the children of Shem and from Asia, and spoke language very similar to Hebrew. And perhaps they were also even called Hebrews, from the verse, and the children of Yoktan, son of Ever. And behold, Pharaoh, in the times of Yosef, who used to love the Hebrews, settled the children of Jacob in the best part of the land, in the land of Ramses. And this land, it is reasonable to believe, was the homestead of one family in Egypt who were called the family of Ramses. And the children of Israel took all of their inheritance, or at least most of it, and settled there. And 200 years later, it happened that the people of Ramses rebelled against the foreign kings from the shepherd families and annihilated them and ruled in their place. And since this family hated the Israelites for taking their land, and also since they were the allies of the shepherds, Pharaoh decreed upon Israel what he decreed. Rav Shmuel David Lutzato, otherwise known as Shaddal, reads into the story of Pharaoh's speech a very real, serious concern that Pharaoh was actually the victim here. Pharaoh and his people, specifically the family of Ramses, had actually been oppressed by a foreign ruler of these shepherds' kings that had come over from the area of Canaan, had taken their homestead, the place of Ramses, and had given it to this family, the Israelites, who were ethnically of the same group as the shepherd kings, to settle there. Basically, the Israelites had become foreign settlers in the land of Ramses, displacing the original Egyptian ethnic group. And then after the shepherd kings of the West had been kicked out of the indigenous lands, the native Egyptians would only want nothing more than to conquer and to take back the land that had been given to the Israelites to settle. And also, they were really afraid. The Israelites were still connected with these shepherd kings of Canaan. They already oppressed the Egyptians, and they were seriously afraid that the Israelites would again be part of this fifth column, part of the enemy other. Here the association, in my mind, in terms of conflicts, international conflicts today, would be, let's say, like the white farmers in Zimbabwe. That after you have a period of colonialism where the natives of the land had been oppressed and their land had been taken, and you have a terrible disproportionate distribution of wealth, you have a few of the people who had decided descendants of the colonialists still staying in the native lands. And it's no wonder that the native population hates them, feels perhaps threatened by them, and then oppresses them. And that's the context, says Shaddal, of why the Egyptians wanted to oppress the Israelites. So it was both fear that they would oppress them, and also a sense of victim, of a deep victim's narrative, that the Egyptians had been oppressed and displaced by the Israelites / Canaanites. So we see here that Shaddal and both and Jubilees go in this direction, but there were other classic rabbinic interpretations that went in a similar direction of reading real concerns of Pharaoh. that what was he ultimately concerned was, with not that the Israelites were just simply going to join a enemy nation and leave the land, because that would sound like almost like it was solving the problem. Okay, the enemy comes, and then they leave. But in the early Aramaic translations of the Bible, known as the Targumim, for example, in Targum Yerushalmi, or in Targum Pseudo-Yonatan, they insert into the words not that they will just simply depart from the land, but beforehand they say, lest when war break out against us, they join on their own with our enemies and destroy us and not leave a single one of us alive, and then depart from the land. Meaning what they were concerned about was seriously being annihilated, was that the Israelites would join and actually kill all of the Egyptian people. Or in the Talmud Bavli in Sotah, page 11a, there it describes that not that the fear was that they were all going to be killed, but that the Israelites were going to take their land and exile all of the Egyptians from their land. Which has happened historically. The people would get conquered, and then all the native people would be sent far away, go into diaspora. But if we read that as the concern, it's no wonder that when a people feel that another group is about to kill all of them, they can justify terrible evils themselves of what they do to that group. That if we feel that any moment all of us are about to be killed, then putting into perspective the motive for why the Egyptians would want to enslave the Israelites is not so shocking at all. And that's totally different than what we had seen in the beginning of our conversation in Josephus, where there was no real fear that they were going to be killed or that they had been oppressed or that their land had been taken away. No, they wanted to simply keep the social hierarchy it is. They didn't want this minority group getting so wealthy and joining their country clubs, running their banks, lending them money. They wanted to simply make sure that they're on top and put the Israelites doing their manual labor. Or in the Rashbam, they didn't want to lose their slaves. That's a very, very different type of concern. Now, this ambiguity of how to interpret the biblical text, and specifically, how do we interpret the motivations behind the oppression, behind the slavery? To what extent were they founded in reality, a real existential threat to their existence? Or was it exaggerated and sinister? This same ambiguity can be found in conflicts throughout the world. To give one example, conflict going on right now, for example, in Europe, over the minority Islamic population. It's very easy to find, for example, many articles that will describe this Islamic minority as any moment as exactly like the Israelites, that they are increasing and becoming fruitful and that they are gaining in strength and that they don't dress the same way, their rules are different, they don't change their names, they're not assimilating, just like the Israelites didn't assimilate inside Egypt. Here I cite an article in our source book, Demographic Time Bomb. Million of Muslim immigrants will change Europe beyond recognition, and almost no policymakers are talking about it. And here I bring a quote. The core of the problem is that they have a ready-made system of laws and customs that they consider superior to the laws and customs of Europe and are ready to replace the one with the other. And their system denies freedom of speech and conscience as well as equality of rights for women and non-Muslims. As such, all free people should be fighting against it. A fifth of European Union will be Muslim by 2050. From the author's perspective, this is a real concern that a minority group could actually outnumber and become more powerful and be a fifth column than the native group. That they are a cultural threat, a physical threat, and therefore, who knows therefore, of what concerns this can have, of how they might have to react or respond in order to preserve their culture. On the same page, I cite here an Islamic woman in Europe who says, saying, quote-unquote, Islamic threat over and over doesn't make it real. And here she writes, Years of peddled fear and demonization have had severe consequences, a widening of ignorance and bigotry, deepening mistrust between individuals and communities, and the resurrection of promiscuous language of racism and fanaticism. The much-hyped Islamic threat is one of the greatest lies of our time. The Muslim world, quote-unquote, though no such bloc really exists, is politically fragmented and economically impoverished. It is reeling under the weight of crisis and a long colonial legacy. Militarily, it is of scant significance. It is laughable that we should be discussing the Islamic threat when in the past 7 years alone, two Muslim countries have come under direct military occupation, ending hopes that the world had firmly closed this chapter of history decades ago. Here again, I intentionally bring two totally different interpretations of what the reality is right now. But they parallel, in my mind, the same ambiguity that goes on between, let's say, the Rashbam on the one hand, who's saying that they hyped, or the Anchor Bible, who interpret that Paro exaggerated in ludicrous ways the strength of the minority for their own political interests or for their own hatred and xenophobia, for their economic interests, keeping their culture the way they want it, like Josephus, versus those interpretations that say, wait a minute, there is a real concern that these Israelites are actually going to become stronger than us and actually kill all of us or destroy entirely our society because they really are more powerful than us. That ambiguity of how we interpret the strength of the other, how we interpret the intentions of the other, is reflected in this unit of why the Egyptians wanted to oppress the Israelites. And again, it is an ambiguity that exists within several different contexts of conflict today. The same thing, by the way, we could find when it comes to what happened just about a year and a half ago in Israel about renting homes to Arabs or non-Jews. That there were certain rabbis who had expressed a verdict, a halachic ruling, that these homes cannot be rented out to Muslims, to Arabs, to non-Jews. And from their narrative, from their interpretation of reality, they really were concerned of demographics, that the Arabs and the Muslims are going to take over Israel. And on the other hand, there were those who were saying, you're crazy, you're xenophobic, you're racist. And I think what these stories in the Bible and the interpretation of these stories can teach us is that realities are extremely complex. And too often, in conflict situations, we're quick to interpret the reality in one way and deny entirely any other opposing interpretation of how to see things. And I would like to challenge ourselves, to say, even if we hold that one interpretation is the correct interpretation, can we still entertain the fact that it is a bit ambiguous and that it's possible that other people are very much experiencing it in a different way, interpreting it, that reality, in a very different way? And I think that this Parsha, in Parsha Shmot, is a good opportunity for us to seriously discuss not just the biblical conflicts, but also how are we managing and transforming our conflicts in society today. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Roth. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.